Dr. Koontz, this week I want to take us on a little journey through, again, media discernment, which I think is a primary goal for me, at least in this podcast, to continue to teach our place in history means to understand the words of the times, the spirit which is at war against us and the sons of disobedience. And a big part of that then is knowing who the liars are, really. Just, you know, finding out where are the sources you can trust, because there are just so many that you cannot. So where I want to start then this week is with a little question for you just about Michael Jackson in general. Like, I know you're not the king of pop yourself. Certainly not where you're at.
Furthest thing,
right?
The opposite, something like that.
What are your memories of Michael Jackson from childhood? Do you have any?
He's weird and he does bad things to kids.
And where did you get that information? Do you know? Do you remember?
You know, Inside Hollywood previews during sports broadcasts.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Does that jive with the picture of him after he died and what was the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, all his music coming back? Did you pick up on any of that, how popular he's become again?
No, not at all. And I think that does have to do with your original interest in sifting through things, is that several people, I don't know, a month ask me, where do you get your news, or what do you read or whatever? And it's like, you know, have you tried extremely detailed Civil War campaign books? Because my interest in Vicksburg far outweighs my interest in Michael Jackson. But when you come to something like Michael Jackson, one thing that not reading all news all the time, and the basic thing that I use is essentially the Google News app, which I will curate every so often in order to give myself information that I'm interested in. So that has an entertainment tab, for example, and I can make sure that it tells me everything possible about Michael Jackson. Or you can also set up Google News alerts. That gives you access to mainstream media, mostly. And what that's going to do is enable you to have to begin to exercise discernment for yourself, because I can't give you, here's the address, go there, it's all great, which I think is the way that people thought about consumption, particularly media consumption. So if I'm thinking about Michael Jackson, the thing that I'm aware of with Michael Jackson is a longer term story. And it's a story that, if you go all the way back to the beginning, not so much of the recording industry in the United States, because that lived in conjunction with something that was sketchy in its own way, and that was live music and theater. And then, you know, recordings begin to come out of that. But there were weird things about that industry, let's say Broadway. It's not exactly called that yet. But when you're into pop as the multi-billion dollar thing that it now is, or even that it was in the 1970s, when Michael Jackson and his siblings were coming up from Gary, Indiana, not a place that you probably want to stay in if you can help it, right? Is that you, and here's the story as old as time, you take an American youth from somewhere he or she doesn't want to live, and you recognize that he or she has incredible talent in some way. And for Michael Jackson, that's singing, obviously. Also dancing, if you go back early enough with him and his brothers. So once that's been spotted by people who are roving, and they always have, right? Sort of like baseball scouts, something I know a little bit more about. Once that's been identified, and you take them from Gary to New York or Los Angeles or wherever, that person is now completely under control. And this is a little bit different from being completely under control the way intelligence agencies will often operate, via blackmail. You don't really need to do blackmail if the person's whole sense of what his life has become is completely dependent on pleasing you. And that's what they do. with children in music and in, you know, let's just say film generally, whether whatever format it's released on. And that's always been the case. I mean, being a child star especially has always been atrocious. You know, you can go find Shirley Temple's biography. So this is where, because human beings exist in patterns, if you learn the patterns from somewhere else, so I'm more interested for my own, you know, just weird antiquarian, I should be running an antique store type of purposes in silent film than I am in normal movies, normal human beings watch. And my, you know, my dad is largely to blame for a lot of this. If you know the patterns from back then, they still apply with Michael Jackson. And any reevaluation that's gone on of him since his death has been, wow, he suffered a lot.
Yeah.
And but that was presented to us as creepy guy with too much money invites kids to sleep over at his ranch.
Right. Yeah. And which so, today, by the way, we're supposed to say is awesome and everyone can do whenever they want. I mean, just notice.
Well, yeah, right.
With the narrative.
Yeah. They will weaponize creepy when they need to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if at 10, all I picked up on was, boy, I hope I never get invited to Neverland Ranch. You know, now, a few years later, I can pick up on, this is somebody who also had so much success that he got to a point where, like a Mel Gibson or an Elon Musk or something, he began to say things that, you know, you're not supposed to say, or to talk about things you're not supposed to talk about. And so whatever the circumstances of his death were, and I'm not real clear on those, this is a very common tale. Jackson was unusual in the success that he enjoyed, and therefore in the ostracism that he endured, because of how he began to act and how he began to speak after that success made him not so much bulletproof as immune to a lot of normal attacks. His life could no longer just be completely destroyed by the people who had brought him to that success.
Yeah, right. And so just feeding this into the larger narrative of the Black music industry as a part of the music industry, just keeping track with, in the last year or three, Ice Cube coming out and talking about the federal involvement in Black music, Cat Williams talking about, you know, these groves. There's more news about the Grove this week as well. We'll leave that for there. But Cat Williams talking about all sorts of stuff. Why would you trust people who lie to you so consistently? And the knowledge that certain people groups could learn from other people groups. And Prince, I can't forget about that guy at all, because he is just the weirdest dude there ever was. And yet I left off Kanye, who's maybe weirder still. You know, all of this, and were they all child stars? Not exactly. Were they any of them child trafficked? I don't know. Although, again, looking at Jackson's life, again, the using up of anybody for the sake of profits, the casting aside of human life, it's just so brutal. And that we forget about it and just watch the next one on the screen as if that's not a real person, it's just a story.
Yeah.
It weighs on me.
Yeah.
It weighs on me. And then the new angle, throw this one in. I mean, I thought there was only one island, right? Well, you know, the Diddy honeypot, Sean Puff Daddy Combs and his house with lots of cameras where other, what this would have been, the late 90s, high school, college for me, more money, more problems is right, Puff Daddy, set up to entrap all manner of whoever you could get there in what looks like, you know, some sort of a honeypot is an operation where you bring in women for men or other things for men to get them to do it. You record it and then now you have them. And this is well known from the Epstein issue with Mossad, the secret services of the Israelites or Israelis who entrapped, well, the lists are still not entirely out. The news now, Diddy had his own. Is it the same as my question, Dr. Koontz? Is there only one evil secret service agency in the world trying to entrap people with sex and drugs?
Yeah. No, because like we talked about last time, the idea that you have what you really need to do to find out what's really going on is you need to find the group in back of everything. And what you can't do because of what, let's say, the shape of evil, is discern one group. And one way to think about this is that you can think about in mythology when ultimate evils are described. So think about Medusa, or think about the Hydra, and there are or Chimera, who produces all kinds of monsters that then have to get chased down throughout the rest of the heroic age of the Greeks. What you're always dealing with, and what's presented to you in the stories, is that evil is multiple in nature. It's not simple, it's not easily observable, and that goodness, by contrast, is simple, is clear, is unambiguous. And one thing that Satan likes to do with stories is make simple, unambiguous good, in the basic sense of the word, incredible. You cannot give any credit to it, incredible to you, so that now the only thing you really believe is that the manifold nature of evil is interesting. And it is interesting, but if it's not contrasted with the simple nature of goodness, your stories are, and our stories are now, very much, here are the wide array of shades from black to dark gray in stories. And that's what you should be interested in, because that's all there is. So when you're thinking about, well, why is entrapment working this way in the music industry, and it's working this way presumably with someone connected to Robert Maxwell, and it's working this way with these other people, is because human beings are always subject, we're not subject to an infinite array of temptations, right? We've been talking about the seven deadly sins, because you can make lists, and even if you use the list from Galatians 5 that we talked about, I think, last time, you're still boiling it down, but you know, to a small number of elements of things that are actually going to entice human beings. So once you do that, you can employ the same tactics in all kinds of different places. So if you want to talk about entrapment, well, it turns out that the KGB and Mossad don't have notably different operating procedures, other than Mossad, as we've mentioned before in shows about Israel, is much more willing to deploy assassination as a tactic than is the KGB historically, right? Or the, I think it's the FSB that replaced it now in modern day Russia. So that's what you're dealing with. So if you talk about the American music industry, or you talk about rap specifically, what you're looking at is just another permutation of the same old stuff. This is where evil does become boring, right? This is where it's no longer very interesting, because you've seen it all before. I don't know specifically with Sean Combs what exactly was going on there. I would say that entrapment is used in the entertainment industry more frequently where the person was already an adult, or let's say, you know, chronologically or psychologically a quasi adult when he got into it. Because adults are most easily entrapped by the vice of lust. Everything else has to play out on a much longer time scale. So you say, I'm going to entrap him through avarice or greed, right? Avaritia. That's going to take a little longer, probably, right, to play out. If I can entrap him through lust, that's kind of a quick, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about how you trap various animals. And when you trap, you know, a very smart animal like a coyote, you need to use something that is going to be immediately interesting to him. You don't have time, because he's not going to fall for other things. So if you take a guy out of his home environment and you're putting money and all kinds of stuff in front of him, if you're trying to entrap him so that he has to be loyal to you against his own best inclinations and desires, the way to do that is through entrapping his lust, because everything else is just going to, it's going to take too long. It might be uncertain, right? If he eats too much, that's the deadly vice of gluttony, right? If he eats too much, you know, that's not necessarily going to make him, you know, pliable. But if you entrap him via his lust, and I think that, you know, the widespread availability of pornography doesn't so much entrap everyone in the sense that it makes everyone, you know, subject to specific blackmail. I mean, theoretically it could, right? You just use what, you know, here's what they've been doing on the computer. The purpose of that is that also kind of demoralizes you, because it takes you to a place even before they say, look, we have these tapes, you know, so you're going to do this because you don't want people to see these tapes, right? It makes you have a sense that you don't really have control over yourself. And that's very important and powerful if you want people to be pliable and behave the way that you're telling them to. Whether you're talking about individuals in a situation where a lot of money is on the line, or if you're talking about the general populace, if you give them a sense that they don't really have control over themselves and they can't, then that is very powerful for behavior modification.
Yeah, that's right. That's a key tactic in the fifth generation warfare, is isolation unto victimization. Since we can't do anything, we'll just watch it burn and laugh, make some memes or something. This whole conversation still really is about coverage then. And without going past Joe Rogan's nod to our Lord Jesus Christ, he did say we need Jesus. I'm not sure what he meant, and I'm not sure if anyone's talked to him since. I'd be happy to. But leaving that behind, Senate hearings revealing that in Palestine, where the explosion occurred, is it a year ago now? Is it a year and a half? You would know better than I.
Yeah, it was last February.
Last February, just a year ago now, that this explosion, a controlled explosion, was unnecessary and did not have to be done. So what this to me says again is, Dr. Kuntz, you've been right. Their evil, and their primary evil at least, is complete incompetence.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a combination here of incompetence mixed with indifference. And incompetence is the issue on the local level, and indifference is the issue on a broader level. And what you're dealing with on the local level is that the only full-time employee of the East Palestine Fire Department is the chief. Everyone else is a volunteer fireman and has to train on the various situations that could happen in his free time. So generally people will take their vacation is occupied training in various situations, basic stuff, but also things like derailments, chemical spills, and so on. There is not enough time or opportunity or funding for something like the East Palestine Fire Department to do that. And the chief, who is still the chief, has always said that. So incompetence in the sense of we don't even know what we're dealing with. Do we need to blow up these particular tanks? Yeah, they had no idea, right? They didn't know what they were looking at. Those were the options given them. The communication about the fact that it wasn't necessary was not arranged by people who knew, both chemical companies involved who had shipped those chemicals, Norfolk Southern, or other parties beyond the local level. So they were not ensuring that someone got to the chief of the fire department to tell him, you don't have to do this. And that indifference to communication with locals is something that you then see played out not just after the derailment and before they actually light these things on fire, which then has a downwind effect in a place that, you know, Darlington, Pennsylvania, that is not and won't be compensated in the same way because the name didn't get attached to the problem in the national news. But the stuff that goes into the water from that combination of incompetence and indifference is so immediately apparent in East Palestine that people will just, you know, have moved out, not all of them, but many of them have moved out because they can smell these chemicals at all times in their homes. If the pertinent creek runs under or near their homes. So that situation of combined incompetence and indifference is what happens when I think that, you know, you're always going to have a limitation in any group of people on how much they can all know together. And because this had not before happened in this way in East Palestine, it's not like they were preparing for this specifically. Norfolk Southern, of course, had things like this before. And the chemical companies shipping these things had things like this before, at least were able to imagine them because they're much more focused. When you have a system of high complexity, which is what our civilization is, that relies not just on high competence. It does. But it also relies on the capacity to trust one another, to have competence in those given areas, and then to have a common means of communication. So when you say that, you know, somebody was talking to me about Appalachia generally and called it the forgotten part of America. That's actually happened more than once, but this is very recently. And I guess that's true. In a way, it's also become sort of a meme. There are plenty of corners of America that are very forgotten. Plenty, all over the place. I've seen many of them. What you're dealing with there, when something is forgotten or when some group of human beings is forgotten, is that the complexity that is available to other people in a way that is relatively high trust and has known communication protocols. This is how you get nice groceries that will be nutritious. This is how you make enough money to afford those nice groceries that will be nutritious. This is how you have a functioning infrastructure, and on and on and on, right? All of that relies on not indifference, right? Some degree of care for the people who are being served by that infrastructure, by those grocery stores, by those train lines, whatever, as well as the competence to run those things well for the benefit of the people served. When you're talking about places being forgotten or local people not really having the competence to handle a situation, it's kind of like, well, you know, you can blame them in some way and say, well, you should have trained for that. And I suppose that's true. I'm sure they've gone back and thought, man, we should have done this instead of, you know, having to do a fundraiser where we stand around on the street holding out one of our boots and have people put cash in it. Like, we really could have used this training. You know, I'm sure they've thought that, but there's a limit to what any group of people, especially on a local level, can do. Our civilization relies on competence and communication very, very broadly. And to me, it, you know, trains have always derailed. Chemicals have always spilled since we have shipped them in any way. The issue is not just that accidents happen, of course they do, but that when they happen, we're relying on the idea that someone will care, someone will act, and so on. And, you know, and when that doesn't happen, that to me is the real marker of decline, not that an accident happened, that a train derailed, because in the whole scheme of things, on a level of probability, not that many trains derail. I mean, I guess in a way it makes it worse, right? Is that when that does happen, you're dealing with a situation where you just, you know, they just obviously don't care. And this is being brought into the Senate. It's really interesting to me how bipartisan the East Palestine thing is, both on a state level in Ohio and in Pennsylvania, and on a national level. This is a case where John Fetterman, for example, who has had a what is this called in wrestling when he, I don't know. We need Colonel Grills on here.
He was struck by God. Let's just say it happened. You know.
Well, I mean, what he has turned into essentially is just a very traditional Western PA Democrat, which means that he's essentially rather conservative. He's very conservative in his personal life. He has a beautiful wife and a nice family. And he's trying to defend little guys. I mean, this is, you know, this is Connor Lamb in the house. This is very, very, very traditional. This is just basic United Steelworkers talking points.
Isn't he also just kind of doing his job, like as a senator?
Well, yeah.
To represent the interests of the region he comes from.
That is the idea, right? That was always the idea. It's just strange when you see it. But
when you get in the club and you're smoking the cigars, you assume you're going to be there forever because they are. And that's a different story a little bit. Continue on with Palestine.
But what's happening there is that East Palestine, in a way, like a lot of environmental issues, happen to be, and I don't mean climate change. I mean like things like there's actually like toxic pollutants in my water, environmental issues. They tend to be fairly bipartisan because somewhat like potholes, they affect everybody. You know, so it's not really something where you just sort of have an opinion about it and it, you know, concerns American intervention in the Middle East or something. But for that reason, it never is going to get the same kind of play that partisan issues that are much more effective for party coffers for fundraising are going to get. And that's just the way it goes. But to me, the breakdown is not just an infrastructural problem. It is even more than that. You could call it, I don't know, the spiritual infrastructure, the mental infrastructure of America, which is you get enormous amounts of it just completely forgotten. But what forgotten means is not only do you not trust me, but also I've made it fairly clear I don't care. And that breakdown and the reasonable expectation of care and of trust and of competence is the thing that I think a lot of people find shocking. Especially if they're not from a forgotten corner to begin with. They're like, whoa, you know, this happens. It's like, yeah, yeah, it does. Because nobody cares. And there's no way that we could know all that. I mean, you know, significantly, this train is passing through East Palestine. You know, I mean, it has nothing to do with East Palestine. It just sort of happens to be there, happens to destroy their town. Happens, right?
Lawlessness is not neutral. And I'm wrestling as you talk with the question put to me by a friend, Missouri Synod pastor still, you know.
Yeah.
Why do these things matter? Aren't we just supposed to do what we're supposed to do anyway? And I mean, when does it not matter that the water supply in your city is filthy? Like, I know you're a Christian, you're going to heaven. I know we just preach Jesus.
Yeah.
Like I'm totally on board. Okay. But like, okay. So for me, it's not my water supply. I got Culligan. Hallelujah to Jesus for Culligan. But there's a lot of people drinking crap water.
And I
care a great deal about that as a Christian. I don't think we can. Right.
I mean, I, you know, honestly, when people ask questions, you know, you know, this with a local congregation, the listeners know this with their families, with their, you know, the department that they're over at work, whatever, right? When people ask questions, there's the informational aspect of their question. Why do we care? Okay, I need to provide you with 2 points about why we care. But there's also the personal aspect of their question. And from that personal perspective, the reason most of us don't care is because we can't actually imagine something like this happening to us.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why. And so it's kind of like, I understand you're not going to care, or I understand you think that our current form of government, this regime, whatever, will just continue to exist. And I think you're wrong. I think you're completely wrong, but I'm not going to argue with you. Because you don't have the imaginative bandwidth to handle this right now. And that's fine. I don't need to argue you into being like, okay, but what if this happens in many, many, many places, right? What if this is a canary in the coal mine rather than just, you know, a random thing that happened elsewhere? And what's interesting is people will only say, why do you care? Generally about domestic problems. you can have a bleeding heart for something going on in a foreign country, and we're all supposed to celebrate that. But if you say, you know, here is the dysfunction in East St. Louis, Illinois, East Palestine, Ohio, whatever, you know, it's just kind of like we look away. Right.
And
this
sure do.
And this generally tracks with the church's much deeper interest in foreign countries than in the United States. It's kind of a peculiar functioning blindness that somehow this is all like basically fine and will always go on. And if you have that presumption of normalcy, which, I mean, you know, to be fair, is the way most humans function most of the time, like everything's normal, right? Like most of us assume inertia in the world. Things are just, you know, that they just go along, like the roads are there. And
yeah, tomorrow will be like today and was like yesterday mostly.
Right. Yeah, right. And you know, for a lot of life purposes, that makes sense. Some of us are a little more disaster-minded, crisis-minded.
Well, it's true a lot of the time. There are whole generations where nothing, you know, radically international happens. Sorry. Yeah. I'm just falling off my own sanity as you talk.
Yeah, but I it's like if you just don't care, that's okay. I need you to not mock or denigrate people who do.
Yeah,
that's all I need. I don't need you to care. I just need you to leave people alone who do care. That's all. That's all, because the people who do care probably have a better sense of what is falling apart than you do.
That's right.
And therefore a better sense of how things need to be renewed or reconstructed or fixed or whatever verb you want to use, if things are not to fall apart entirely.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that theologically, you know, specific to theology, I tend to trust the observations of parish pastors more than anybody else. And it's because we have to deal with the actual derailment. We're not in control of the entire system. We don't have a sense of where all the lines are. We don't know exactly how much freight is shipped, you know, somewhere across the country. But we do watch, you know, this specific train derailed, and here's why. And that gives you, and that, for instance, is something that you see with a lot of the sexual issues that you would deal with on a day-to-day basis long before they come to the attention of a larger group. A perfect example for me of this is that Pope Francis, in authorizing same-sex blessings, did something for which he would be applauded by the New York Times. And that would make certain large constituencies in his church happy, especially the Europeans and Americans, some of the Americans anyway, many of the Europeans anyway, who pay the bills for his church. I mean, we can celebrate Africans standing firm against this all day long. The brutal reality is Europe and America pay the bills. Okay. So political action in the Roman Catholic Church has to recognize that. That's who pays for stuff to happen. Africans don't do that. Latin Americans don't do that. Okay. On the ground in Europe and Africa and North America and everywhere else, on the ground, your average parish priest is going to be like, this is incredibly stupid. This is one of the dumbest things you've ever done, because it contravenes our sense of what blessing is. It contravenes our sense of what marriage is. It makes it confused. It contravenes our sense of, Catholics have been very good on the sense of nature and of purpose in human relationships, specifically in marriage.
Theology of the body.
Yeah, theology of the body. It goes against all of that, and it puts it concretely in the eyes of a parish. Even if it's not happening in their parish, it's happening in another parish in their diocese. Their bishop is saying it's fine, whatever. It puts in front of them this example: you can sleep with another man if you're a man, and it's kind of okay. It's kind of okay. And the priest had the two of you stand up, and he said some words over you. Looks a lot kind of like you're married. right? So this is absolutely disastrous, absolutely stupid. And it's because Francis has no cognizance, or he's at least taking no cognizance, of what the guys that actually have to run the railroad deal with and do and encounter, right? So if someone else has a sense of this, right? If it's like 1995 and someone who is a parish priest in San Francisco tells me, 1995, tells me, he says, you know, this is where things are headed, I can say to him, that's crazy. You're just alarmist. That's just San Francisco. That's a Democrat-run city. Whatever. Whatever cope I want to come up with, I can, you know, all day long, I can, that's not going to happen. Guess what? It did, you know? So, you know, if somebody is like fervent about something or has a very lively sense of it, I try not to just dismiss that, because instead I want to understand, well, where did he come from? I know where the guy who's like indifferent because he's lived a comfortable life and he's in a comfortable place. He's a parish pastor in a comfortable situation. So maybe he's got, you know, he, however, might be much more alarmed about divorce than his congregants are, because he deals with it every time a marriage falls apart. They don't, right? But if some guy is alarmist about something, I tend to ask myself, you know, where's he coming from? I know where Mr. Indifference is coming from. That's, you know, that's fine. You know, he's just going to log on to his streaming subscription tonight, just like last night. I want to know where the alarmist is coming from, not because he's infallible, but because he's gone through something that might actually be typical or characteristic or part of a larger pattern or something. So, you know, that's why you want to care. It's not because you have to have a personal deep interest in everything that happens. It's because these kinds of things often serve, and with time prove to be, something like bellwethers or canaries in the coal mine that show you an approaching danger that otherwise you're going to be blindsided by.
Yeah, you're pointing out that we don't have the imagination to foresee what it's like when we're in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's our kids that, yeah, one just, well, that one's dead now. And we got to keep running though. You know, like it's not that I don't believe Jesus will be with me in that moment. I'd just like to have a prayer discipline ready for that kind of life if it should happen. And honestly, that means one that is, can I say, Lindy from Tlaib? It is enduring. Prayer life, which is able to endure any crisis, can endure any stasis as well. I want to move kind of forward, but it's kind of the same. I'm going to catch a bunch of other news pieces here in the same sketch, dealing with what are we, you and I, alarmist about these several years of A Brief History of Power. I think the collapse of the U.S. currency, planned or unplanned, is sort of a big piece of this. And so that now in 2024, Forbes is writing kind of casually about Bank of America, warning about a collapse of U.N.'s currency and, you know, how to be, that's coming. it's mainstream now, this idea.
Yeah.
It is the thing that is not a conspiracy theory, as if currency markets were ever about conspiracies, aside from the Fed. But like we're tracking the gold standard isn't a conspiracy. That's just looking at the markets, right? You're just understanding how value works. So this is going mainstream now at the same time that, and these links to this will be in the show notes, that Senator Bob Menendez's home was linked to this 2013 robbery with gold bars being found in. This, all this news is kind of going on right now in the courts. Okay. So we have a sitting senator with lots of gold bars possibly stolen. You know, is he innocent until proven guilty? My point is, listen to the looting phase and understand its meaning, because it will impact your preaching. It really matters that the people in the pew are having stuff taken from them. They know it. They know what they're being lost for, what they're losing. You get up there and you just talk about jargon again. They'll listen because they're pious. But what are they going to take and do with it? That's the question. And our faith is not passive alone. We're saved passively. That is, we're inspired from the outside. We're regenerate by God. But that is not a regeneration unto sleep, at least not yet. Are you dead yet? And so, you know, putting these together with the replacement theory a little bit here, and is she everyone's favorite WASP governor who's not? You know, I don't know. Michigan's pretty rough. Kathy Hochul is working to remove red tape that would allow illegal immigrants, they call them migrants in this news station,
yeah,
to obtain state jobs. And, you know, that just happened to be in my Twitter feed, besides Alex Jones talking about foreign troops in the military and police. And I cannot run past, but I don't have a link to, a news story from a couple of months ago about certain counties in LA having to begin strip searching their officers to inspect them for Mexican cartel tattoos. All right. So the idea that the guy who shows up at your door as a cop this afternoon is a Mexican cartel guy.
Yeah.
New York, are you ready? It's already happening already. I can't imagine the linguistics nightmare this will cause for HR, no matter where you are in New York government, you know, which is taxes, water, whatever. But the idea here again is that this immigration, we can't ignore the numbers that are here. And New York is out in front saying, this is how we, the regime, plan to do this. We're going to give them jobs you won't take. They're going to vote for us. So understanding that reality of the American economic collapse looting phase, and just so we don't miss this piece of news, there's nowhere else to go. Don't miss it. Senator Kamala Harris exited the Capitol at 11:21 a.m. on January 6th and has lied about it multiple times since. Why would she do that? I don't even know. But it's just, you can't miss it. It keeps coming. It'll be gone next week. Liars and the lies who tell them. Dr. Kuntz, what's a poor Christian to do?
Yeah, I want to bookmark the Menendez thing, because that's a story that deserves to be explained in its fullness, and it goes back at least 20 years to what, you know, what are we going to, now that New Jersey has been developed as the perfect suburban place, and people are going to laugh, they're going to think that's ironic. It wasn't supposed to be. It was called the Garden State without irony. Now that New Jersey has been developed as the perfect suburban place, and that has sort of petered out and people don't want to live there, or the taxes are too high, you know, they're going to move to North Carolina, Florida, whatever. What are we going to do with it? And it has to do with the development and the Renaissance under Giuliani of New York City, and therefore the development of North Jersey as the annex of Manhattan's revival or Renaissance in the 90s and 2000s. Because the gold bars that were found in Menendez's home have serial numbers stamped on them connected to this robbery from now 11 years ago of the man, Fred Dibes, I think is how you say it. But, you know, I want to look this up for my, and just lay this out sometime for my own purposes, who is most responsible for the development of North Jersey, for its Renaissance along that Hudson River corridor. So that's a situation where Menendez we can use as a case study for something that you can see, whether you're talking about Kathy Hochul's immigration policy, and I, you know, make sure that I come back to that not another time but today, and that you can also see with the rise of Kamala Harris, who has been promoted beyond competence several times and has never needed to demonstrate a whole lot in her current position in order to get promoted again. All of that
depends
is
on which memes you're looking at, Dr. Kuntz. It depends on which memes you're looking at.
All of that is premised on the fact that in our configuration of government, I'm not saying our constitution, was built for a very different society with a completely different economic basis. In our configuration, where the dollar is truly almighty, Plato would say that every democracy is a looting stage. You're not in the looting stage of a democracy. A democracy is a looting stage. Now, that's supposed to be distinct in his thinking in the Republic. Bad translation. from what we would call a republic. So a republic and a democracy are not the same thing. They're both in some measure representative, but the people are directly ruling, allegedly, in a democracy. They never actually are, because everyone is paid off in a democracy. So you only get generally incompetent, definitely looting types of people in these positions, especially in elected positions. You're actually going to get more competent people in appointed positions generally, because they probably had to actually do something, probably, in order to get there. In order to be elected, they simply had to be compliant to their donors and appealing to the voters. That's all. That's all they had to do. And that doesn't select for a highly honorable or competent sort of a human being. Because all that's premised on the dollar and the dollar's health, the dollar's decline has effects far beyond, strictly speaking, the value of one's wallet. And that is a crash I'm not sure most of us are ready for. I mean, I'm personally dismayed by the incredible performance of my crypto portfolio. like that's a very bad sign.
Unless you know what it means. I agree with you entirely here, because I don't want to live through it, but I'm glad you've understood enough to see to diversify. And we shouldn't go past that too quickly for the listeners, that Bitcoin did all but double in the last week. I haven't looked
today. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's hit a plateau where it will sit at and or fall back, but it'll be higher than where it was. It's been doing this forever. It's going to keep doing it, I think, because whatever the base code might look like, and I haven't gone digging for demons there yet, it is a philosophy that prevents cheating in the books as code. And until they break the code, I don't see how they can keep stealing and not have it be worth more. And yeah, the electricity has to work. And yeah, you need the internet. So you game out the world without electricity and without internet. And in that world, you don't need Bitcoin. In any other world, Bitcoin's at least a 50-50 the next money.
Yeah.
And it's going to transition to that over the next 15 or 30 years. That means if you buy Bitcoin now, which don't buy it right now, wait for a week and a half, I'd say, at least. If it keeps going up, maybe buy. I'm not giving any of that advice anymore. I'm out at this point in terms of the buy market. But where it goes, again, from here is you buy in and you get yourself one Bitcoin at 60,000. And the way the philosophy of this whole thing works is, I mean, we got to replace trillions of US dollars. Trillions. Bitcoin is available all over your city in where you wouldn't expect. You go in to buy a coffee or a drink while you're getting your gas, and you don't see that there's a Bitcoin dispensary, or, well, it's actually just a takery there. It takes in the dollars and puts out the Bitcoin. And whenever you buy Bitcoin, it feels a bit sketchy if you do it in these places. And that's because it is sketchy. It's often used for black market activity. No one's buying a whole Bitcoin. Well, there are people. Somebody just bought like $3 billion worth of Bitcoin over the last year in $25 million chunks. That's part of what's made the price go up. But many people are buying Bitcoin to use Bitcoin for black market things. Just think prostitution and the drugs that are killing people, right? That is sure. They use cash too. They're putting their cash in, blah, 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 blah. It's not Bitcoin. It's cash falling apart that's going to drive Bitcoin operating where it cannot be followed to be the safe haven it will be, which is why South American countries, like I believe is Ecuador, are normalizing it as their standard currency. So to see it double right now, it's on a peak, it's going up. If you know anything about markets, now's not the time to try to buy. Now's when people are thinking about selling. But this is not going to stop doing this. And, you know, people joke about, was it 15 years ago? You're buying pizzas for a whole Bitcoin. You know, if you got in and held on, and people did and do, again, can crypto survive? It's one of many stories. You can't eat your gold either, right? There's a problem with all of it, right? The EMP takes out your generator and the water won't come. Jesus is in charge. Don't ignore crypto. Don't ignore it. It's real. So thanks, Dr. Koons.
That's fine. Let me talk a little bit about New York State before we wrap up here. And that is, you know, why would Kathy Hochul make it legal for illegal immigrants to get state jobs. She's really just bringing to a smaller level what is functionally the case for our military, which is that if you can get in any way, and I know, and I'm sure, you know, on the books, you can't enlist as an illegal immigrant, but I'm also aware of gang activity in the U.S. military, as well as the L.A. Police Department. So, you know, I'm partially suspicious of these things. But what you can do, even if you're a legal immigrant, is you can get U.S. citizenship through service. So the theory here about New York State is that you would want to bring in people who have no compunction about enforcing draconian laws on other people because they don't identify with the population in the way that historically, like a National Guard or, you know, a county clerk would, obviously, you know. That's part of this theory. Part of the theory too is that you form, and this is a tale. I said a tale as old as time to describe the entertainment industry at the beginning of the episode. This is a tale much older than time, if you want to, although obviously it's not, that when you have an empire in need of populations to accomplish some imperial goal that for various reasons cannot be accomplished by the population you already have, you're going to bring in a new population. Advocacy for immigration has always been in American history the purview of big business because it wants the value of labor to be diluted. I mean, this was an absolute commonplace of the Democratic Party until roughly the 90s, is that we're generally anti-immigration, legal or illegal, certainly illegal. Nobody was really for that exactly. But even legal, because it dilutes the value of labor. This seems kind of obvious, right? Like if I have 20 widgets and now I have 200 widgets, the value of widgets has suddenly plummeted. It's kind of really extremely basic. But if you go back even farther, the reason you would bring in large populations from wherever is because you want to staff the empire differently. So in Roman history, for example, eventually you turn a citizen army that is full-time trained, but essentially part-time soldiers, sort of a militia or a National Guard type setup in the Roman Republic. And eventually you turn it into a full-time standing army that by necessity has to be staffed by non-Romans. In New York State, there's a vast difference between Governor Hochul and Mayor Adams, the mayor of New York City, in their approach to immigration. Adams is supposed to be maintaining a sanctuary city policy. He simply can't. He just cannot. He does not. He's reaching the scarcity thing that we've been talking about vis-a-vis immigration, and he just can't handle it anymore. They have tried to export migrants to Binghamton, to all kinds of places. Those local authorities are not necessarily having it. What do you do then if you both want staffing, but also because when you bring in these populations, at least for a while, they are client populations, right? You know, that's the reality. For a while, the Germans who were brought into the Roman Empire were loyal client populations, even against their own kinsmen, people who spoke their language and had their customs. They, you know, the ones who had been brought into the empire were loyal for a long time. I mean, eventually they weren't, but you're talking about hundreds of years in that case. If you have an empire doing that, they're doing that to form new client populations. So now in upstate New York, if you bring in enough, now you have an Arab client population, you have a Venezuelan client population, whatever, and then they will be loyal Democratic voters, and that will be secured as it is in states with very low immigration that are somehow still mysteriously largely democratically run, like Kentucky. Kentucky's very white and very low immigration. why is it democratic? Well, it's because the loyalty of the people is secured through patronage. So if you can extend patronage to new populations, not only do you fill spots for whatever purposes you have, right? She's sending the National Guard to the New York subway right now, as we record this.
It's insane.
Right. It basically just in order to keep, you know, things from being completely insane. Sure. Whatever you're going to do, right? But the larger or the longer game is to form fresh client populations that will not only seemingly have an unlimited supply, because with the modern United States, you're not talking about bringing them from what's now Germany into what's now France, like the Romans did. You can bring anybody from anywhere. So you have this constant supply, the value of labor can be constantly diluted, and you will have populations that, at least for the foreseeable future, and certainly for the life cycle of an American politician, will be helpful to you. I mean, it seems obvious, and I think if the GOP thought they could do it, they would.
Ah, GOP. you'd like to think. It dawned on me a while back, but I still think this is right on, that we are the colonies still. The banking system will tell you that. And that this land has been given over to what those who reign consider the common, while those who reign are pressing for great licentiousness and evil amongst their own ranks. What does it mean? It means Christians must prepare to live in a world of diverse bigotry controlled by lying people who we can't stop from doing what they're doing. In that world, ignorance is not loving. Passivity is not kindness, and doing nothing is not being faithful. You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you wouldn't be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable, a college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran, a college that won't take a dime of federal funding, a college that teaches the best of our Western heritage, a college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College, a college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful Inland Northwest.